Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know, but all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Let's jump into how to get swole, big, muscular, put on size, and get an amazing body. In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show,
your first goal is to get lean, ideally 10 to 12% body fat. And there's a lot of psychological and physiological benefits to that. So one of the big physiological benefits is that we're going to improve your testosterone levels.
Lean is in. So a lot of people just get 10, 12% body fat and they're like, crap, I love the way I look right now. I don't need to add any more mass. Maybe I'll focus on improving my shoulders and I'll stay at maintenance calories or just, you know, increase calories a bit on those, you know, shoulder and arm days.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power, speed, mobility, balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield here, and I think it was like 8 or 9 years ago that I was sitting slack-jawed in this crowd at an event called the Fitness Business Summit, listening to this guy who they billed as, I believe they called him like the mysterious Mr. X or something along those lines, but he was like this massive muscle-bound trainer up on stage. And in this case, he was telling a story about like this ebook that he made, this online book. And I really wasn't familiar with ebooks or, you know, information programs online or anything like that. But he was talking about this ebook that literally made millions of dollars online and had been used by hundreds of thousands of skinny guys all over the globe for sculpting their bodies into these Herculean Adonis-like physiques. So I actually got so inspired by the story that this guy told that I went on and I created my own kind of training program that I wound up selling online. It was a training system for Ironman triathletes to train on less than 10 hours a week and still do Ironman. And I called that one the Triathlon Dominator. And it was the first big training program that I ever sold online inspired by this guy. So there's this kind of odd collision of fitness worlds, because a few weeks ago, his book, a newer book, not this other one that I had seen 8 or 9 years ago, but this new book arrived to me in the mail, and lo and behold, it was written by the mysterious Mr. X, and his name is Vince Delmonte. You may have heard of him before. He used to be known as Skinny Vinny, and now he goes by the name The Skinny Guy Savior. So this book that he sent me, I almost put down, because usually when I get books like this, they're just musclehead content. It's just like, you know, eat a bunch of whey protein, drink Mad in a can, crap out of a straw, and lift heavy stuff. And this book is actually intelligently written. It's got a lot of practical advice in it, and it goes into some really good information about how to put some rock solid shredded muscle onto your body without using drugs or expensive supplements or spending copious amounts of time in the gym. So I was pretty pleased to not only read this book by Vince, but to reconnect with him and get him on the show today. So Vince, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you, Ben. Holy mackerel. I got to tell you, man, I'm a little bit nervous. I've been listening to your podcast for some time now, man. You've stepped up your game huge, man. I learned so much from your podcast and your people you interview. So it's an honor to be here.
Well, it's all about getting smart slash jacked guys like you on the show, man. And I had your wife on. Your wife was actually a guest last year. We had a podcast episode about kitchen items and detoxing.
You're getting interviewed by Ben Greenfield, Flavia. Holy cow, I was so pumped. Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, and by the way, for those of you listening in, I'll link to my interview with Vinny's wife and also everything that we talk about in today's show. If you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/livinglarge, because that's the name of Vince's new book. It's called Living Large, The Skinny Guy's Guide to No-Nonsense Muscle Building. And lest you be a female about to press stop on this podcast, you may want to keep listening in, because there's a lot of stuff in here that's relevant to anybody that picks up weight at a gym. And by the way, Vince, I'm going to blame you for my extremely sore chesticles this morning, because I was going through your book yesterday to prep for this interview, and a big part of it is being mindful, right? Like really focusing on the muscles that you want to work. And I was at the gym yesterday doing, of all things, the pec deck. I don't spend a lot of time on the pec deck. I'm big time into functional exercise, but My kids had a tennis class at the gym, so I just had some time to dink around at the gym. So I was like, I'm going to do some of Vinny's techniques here and see how they feel. And my pecs are definitely feeling it today.
Man, that's we could talk an hour about that one idea there, but I know we've got some questions, so that's fantastic.
For sure. And you know, you used to be, I mean, obviously I just alluded to the fact that you used to be skinny, but you actually used to be like a triathlete or an endurance athlete, didn't you?
Yeah, I actually represented Canada. I went to the World Triathlon Championships in my teens. I was a provincial and national level runner. So endurance running, endurance sport was my life. My father got me and my two younger brothers into running. My youngest brother, I went to the Olympic trials for the 800 meters. And we come from an endurance background, and it's probably one of the most important things I'll hand off to my own kids, because I truly believe that my endurance days solidified my spirit and a lot of character traits, if you will, to do what I do today with business and other areas of life.
Yeah, endurance sports are a really, really good way to get more stubborn than a donkey. Like for better or for worse, I've learned that endurance athletes just don't quit. So they at least have that going for them.
Yeah. So that was the big thing with me. I was always, a scrawny little runner. And you know this as well, like endurance athletes aren't wussies. Like we might look like wussies, but we are beasts. Like we are tougher than nails and we feel like ultimate warriors on the inside. You know, after a track workout, a swim workout, a long bike, I mean, I feel unstoppable. I mean, I'm not intimidated of, anything yet. On the outside, you don't look like that. You know what I'm saying? Walk into a bar, nobody even notices you unless you have some amazing sense of humor. I mean, you're getting walked by every hot girl in that. You know, that was kind of like my high school days, and those were my university days, skinny Vinny.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I when I was competing in triathlon, and I still do dabble in triathlon a bit, I'm big for a triathlete, right? Like I'm broad shouldered. I've my arms aren't complete noodles. And yet, when I was doing Ironman triathlon, I would be, you talk about walking into the bar, I'd be the skinniest guy in the bar. You could be big as a triathlete or big as a marathoner and still be relatively scrawny when it comes to being able to stick up for yourself or chop wood, carry water, or do whatever else you need to do from a functional movement standpoint.
Yeah. So that was kind of my story. When I went to university and an interesting thing happened, I shacked up with a bunch of guys. We were all in the exercise science program. And I just happened to live with a couple of the most jacked guys on campus. I kid you not. These were the guys that other guys wanted to be and that the girls wanted to be with. And these were my roommates. So, I was in that situation where I was going to the bar, hanging out with these guys and all these beautiful women around us. And I'm like, crap, this guy's going to get laid again tonight. And these girls didn't even notice me. And it was just like that, burning, frustration with like, why can't I get that same kind of attention? But because I was a runner, that's where my identity was, right? I was a very good runner. So I just went through university with like living vicariously through these guys and always having this curiosity about, what if I transferred my efforts from running an endurance sport into the gym? How big could I get? How strong could I get? And at the same time, my eligibility was over at the end of university. So, you don't really make a career out of endurance sport, as a professional athlete. And, I was kind of, I'll be honest, more of a mid-packer. I wasn't like, winning. So there wasn't really a future with competitive distance running.
Right.
And at the same time, wrapping up my degree, I was getting into the real world. I just had to learn how to make some money. So I became a personal trainer. And at the same time, I didn't look like a personal trainer. So I had like these, these multiple things all coming together at the same time. I was sick and tired of my nickname, Skinny Vinny. I had all this like muscle rubbing off on me that, I was ready to now, see what I could do in the gym. And I needed to start a career. So I was highly incentivized to transform back in 2002.
So did you it's actually really interesting because I took the complete opposite approach as you, right? Like I was a big bodybuilder. I weigh, well, right now standing here, I weigh about 175 and I was 215 as a bodybuilder. So I was 40 pounds heavier than I am now. And this was back in college. And when I decided, you know, I remember I visited an Ironman triathlon and I saw these people crossing the finish line. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to experience that. And of course, my first triathlon, you know, speaking of sore pecs, just from my huge bodybuilding pecs bouncing up and down during my very first triathlon. I remember that alone, along with my ripped back locking up halfway through the run, inspired me to actually lose some muscle to get good at triathlon. And I wound up doing lots and lots of fasted aerobic workouts to basically eat away my muscle so I could get faster at triathlon. You know what? I'm not claiming that is necessarily healthy, because I do believe that, you know, as you go into your later years of life, you definitely want more muscle just because of sarcopenia and muscle loss and all the things that happen from a longevity standpoint when you lose muscle. But regardless, I went from big to skinny, and you did the opposite. You went from skinny endurance athlete to big. And I'm curious, you know, before we delve into some of the tactics in this book, like what'd you do to actually put on as much size as you did? Cause the photos in your book are pretty amazing. I mean, were you using steroids? Were you eating just like copious amounts of an extremely high protein diet? Like what were some of your biggest tactics?
Yeah, for sure. So absolutely no steroids. This was back when I was 22. So I'll be honest, I didn't even know what steroids were. And the only supplements I used were a fish oil, a weight gainer, and creatine. And it's funny because, you know, my mom had never seen, you know, a tub of powder in her cupboards before. She actually thought it was steroids and she threw it in the garbage. So my first experience with supplements was a negative one. And this was when I was 22. So I moved back home, was living with my parents. And because I used to run 60 to literally 100 miles per week as a competitive runner, you know, I stopped running completely. So there's a couple things that all happen at once. And I like to give context to my transformation because people hear how much muscle I gained and that's what they quickly ask. Oh, you must have taken steroids. And we can dive into what the science talks about in terms of realistic muscle gains and what the research has shown and all that. But I started off 149. So that's when I took my before picture, May 4th, 2002. And I stopped running completely and I started weight training. So I was a newbie. So my gains were definitely what you would call newbie gains. And I literally started doing what the bodybuilders taught in the magazines. I did 6 meals a day. I did 3 shakes a day, weight gain shakes, plus I did 3 whole food meals a day. And that was pretty much it. I didn't, you know, track the macros. I didn't know like I wasn't very precise, but I was consistent with my meal frequency. And I focused on eating 6 times a day, which was something I had never really done as an endurance runner. I mean, I didn't even really know what protein was as a runner. We lived on bagels, pasta, Kraft dinner, peanut butter jam sandwiches. I mean, you know, we just figured we burn it up. So I actually started thinking about what I was putting into my body for the first time. So that was pretty much it. And when it came to weight training, I mean, again, it's so boring. I found this guy at my church of all places who was a provincial level natural bodybuilder. And, you know, I told him I'm about to do this split that I found in a bodybuilding magazine. And he advised that I do full body workouts. And I never like really understood what's a full body workout. And he says, well, we're going to hit the same muscle groups 3 times per week with lower volume, but higher intensity.
Which you actually don't hear a lot from the bodybuilding crowd.
No, it's fascinating because the bodybuilding crowd, we could talk about drugs for an hour here, but it really is a drug subculture. So, you know, he was teaching me stuff that quickly made sense to me because, you know, in track, you know, you don't bump up to the 10K unless you improve your 5K first. You know what I mean? It's all about quality before quantity, especially when you're trying to get better. So he was like, he kept it really simple. He said, why are you going to go to the gym and do 12 sets on your shoulders, you know, when we could get the same stimulus, a sufficient stimulus with 1 or 2 sets? And I said, is that all we need? And he said, well, if it's done with quality. So early on, I was introduced to the whole idea of quality versus quantity, and that we want to stimulate our muscles and not annihilate our muscles. And he started talking about avoiding, you know, concepts like junk volume. And I was like, this is fascinating because this is like you know, whenever I get into junk volume with my endurance sports, when I got hurt, when I burned out. So a lot of this stuff made sense to me. So it was easy to put my trust in him. And that was essentially it. You know, I followed full body workouts. And I said, what about this? What about that? And he really kept it simple. We changed up the exercises each workout. And we just focused on different stimuluses within the workout with different rep ranges. And I just trust the program. I stuck with the program. And 6 months later, I went from 149 to 190. And that was like a life-changing event for me.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. In defense of the high volume approach, you know, I know a lot of like mesomorphic or endomorphic body types, right? Guys who are pretty big to start with, pretty muscular to start with, or just have bigger bones to start with. And many of them seem to do okay with this whole idea of body part splits, right? Like working the chest and the shoulders on a Monday and the biceps and triceps and core on a Tuesday, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, you know, because I'm a skinny guy, back when I was bodybuilding, what worked for me was very similar to the advice that you got from this first mentor. And that was full body 3 times a week. And the way that I did it was I had full body 3 times a week. And then I had one day where I'd go in and do my vanity exercises, right? Where I'd have just a day where I focused on like the biceps and the calves and the triceps. But aside from that, I mean, for my bodybuilding routine back in the day, I was doing deadlifts and cleans and clean and jerk and push press and a lot of these exercises that would be considered more either weightlifting or powerlifting exercises, not these single joint bodybuilding exercises.
No, I hope I fully hear you. And I teach a couple ideas. You know, when it comes to figuring out, people always ask me, should I do a full body or should I do a split? And as you know, it always comes down to these two boring words. It depends. And I always tell people it depends on your recovery ability. And I tell people you are, this is worth writing down for people listening, you are what you can recover from. So, you know, there are people who can recover quicker. And if somebody's maybe taking steroids, they're definitely recovering quicker. Mm. So they can introduce a stimulus to their body at a more frequent rate. So they'll have more repeated bouts, more repeated stimuluses on the muscle. So they'll be able to produce more muscle growth over the course of the year. So at the end of the day, we definitely want to train our body to be able to do more. Like that's the ultimate goal. And most of my training programs, the way they're designed is, you know, for the first, you know, the book you've got there in front of you, the first 10 weeks is dedicated to full body workouts, but we don't stay there forever. We definitely are going to challenge your body to recover at a quicker rate. So in the second 10 weeks, we train 4 times per week. And the frequency, the stimulus to each muscle group is not every 7 days, it's every 5 days. And then in the final phase, in the final 10 weeks, we bump the training frequency up again. And then after those 10 weeks, we'll go back to a full body. So we're always cycling training frequency. So we're not doing the same training frequency all year round. And that's why these different cycling, these approaches works, because your body will get slightly overtrained and then it's going to need to recover. And then it'll be slightly undertrained and then we overtrain it. So we're constantly skillfully organizing these different variables in a way that allows our body to avoid plateau and to avoid adaptation. So we're always moving forward.
Yeah, that's interesting too, what you say about steroids, how they can enhance or speed up recovery. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that is musculoskeletal recovery. It's not nervous system recovery. It's not neuromuscular recovery. And so, you know, for example, there's two ways that I'll recommend to people to track your true recovery, right? Like whether, because you can just pay attention to soreness to know if your musculoskeletal system is recovered. But for neuromuscular recovery, you can do like a morning heart rate variability test. And in many cases, you know, especially if you're taking steroids or some other, form of supplement that vastly enhances musculoskeletal recovery but doesn't act on your nervous system, you'll notice that even if you're not sore anymore, your heart rate variability stays low. And it's very easy to work yourself into a state of like low libido or overtraining or exhausted hormones by using something like steroids for enhancing musculoskeletal recovery. The other one that I like is called, I don't know if you've done this before, Vince, the CNS tap test. It's like this little app that you put on your phone and it lets you keep a running tally of how quickly you can tap with your thumbs on the screen for your right and your left hand. Have you ever messed around with that?
I haven't.
it's kind of cool. And if you're slow, that means that it's probably not a good day for you to do like a hard power or strength workout. The same thing, like if your heart rate variability is low, unless you're purposefully, as you alluded to, like trying to get yourself to like a slightly overtrained state so you can super compensate, you know, you'd want to back off. But steroids kind of mask all that. So
you're literally forced to do more when you take steroids.
Right.
I mean, that's why these guys have to do so much more, because their body's recovering at a ridiculous rate and protein synthesis is occurring at a different way because their chemistry has been altered. So yeah, I find like that's the problem. A lot of guys get easily influenced by their, you know, favorite YouTube idol, their favorite bodybuilder who's promoting these hardcore workouts, when in fact, you know, I find the biggest problem with guys not making gains is they are doing too much. And when you go into the gym, if I say, hey, okay, Ben, we're going to be doing 24 sets today on chest, your first thought is like, crap, I've got to pace myself. You know, I've got to make it through. And we have this mentality and this satisfaction around like just finishing the workout, when muscle growth for natural guys is completely different. We just need to go in there, stimulate the muscle, do a little extra than last time, and then get out of the gym.
Yeah.
Fortunately, that's not too sexy, but unfortunately, it's the non-sexy stuff that gets results. So, you know, bringing somebody's overall volume down. Like if I tell you, hey, we're going to train chest today and we're only doing one all-out set, you're gonna be like, just one set? I'm like, yes, but it's gonna be an all-out ball busting, go till you blow set. We're gonna spend 75% of the workout's gonna be spent warming up, preparing for this all-out set, and then we're gonna do this set, and you're gonna experience more muscle recruitment, more muscle fatigue than you ever have, and that'll be sufficient because you've just outdone your previous workout. And now we're gonna move on to the next body part. And that's like an approach that when guys really embrace and experience, they never go back to these high volume junk set programs that force you to pace yourself and that are only ideal for genetic freaks,
yeah,
or guys who are enhanced.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes total sense.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? Yeah, check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with him, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Leela Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks.
Now, in the book, I want to delve into some of like the principles that you outline in the book. For example, you have this idea that you write about where you're supposed to get lean to get big. And I wanted to ask you, what exactly you mean when you say you got to get lean to get big?
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. So two things that are going to help you build muscle quicker, and that's the state of leanness you're in. So we always tell guys, so a lot of people listening to this call have a certain percentage body fat. It might be 12%, it might be 15%, it might be 20%. And before you even think about building muscle, your first goal is to get lean, ideally 10 to 12% body fat. And there's a lot of psychological and physiological benefits to that. So one of the big physiological benefits is that we're going to improve your testosterone levels. We're going to help lower, by getting leaner, we're going to lower estrogen levels, a female sex hormone that's going to prevent you from optimizing that, you know, male master hormone, if you will.
So what you're talking about primarily is the ability of fat cells to store estrogens or to release estrogens?
Yes.
Okay. So you're looking at like the testosterone to estrogen ratio.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Gotcha. Now could you play devil's advocate here and say that, you know, because you see this in a lot of people, and I even recently, you know, I visited an anti-aging clinic down in Florida to do a study, and this was a few weeks ago, and they put me on a bioimpedance scale, which isn't like the gold standard for body fat, but they tested my body fat and it was pretty low. It's at like 3%. And they told me, you know, one of the things they've noticed is guys with hypogonadism or guys who have low testosterone, a lot of times they'll be down around that range, that, you know, the testosterone will be too low. So where do you strike a balance?
So they're too low being overweight or underweight?
No, like if you lose too much body fat, you can actually lower your testosterone.
Yeah. So I think that really starts, I actually experienced that myself when I competed, because I got my levels checked the day after the show, and they were in the absolute worst state. They were like horrendous. They were all in the toilet, and it was because of, you know, deprivation, dieting, low fats, low calories for a very, very extended period of time. So, you know, for what we're talking about, 10 to 12% body fat, we're talking about body fat levels that should be sustainable over time. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see what body fat levels they're specifically talking about, because your test levels shouldn't plummet when you're, you know, in that 10 to 12% range. They're definitely going to plummet when you start getting into single digit body fat. But a lot of this can be also interacted with, you know, regular refeed meals or cheat days, which is a really essential, you know, very important way to maintain testosterone levels as you get leaner. But overall, a leaner individual is going to be able, they're going to have better machinery, if you will, to build muscle. And
I think it comes down, by the way, to like essential body fat stores, because it depends on the body type. Obviously, like somebody who's a mesomorphic or an endomorphic body type is going to have essential body fat stores that are higher, right? That are like 10 or 15%. And a naturally skinny person might have essential body fat stores of like, oftentimes you'll see like 6 or 7 or 8%. And then once you drop below that essential body fat store, you know, for a lot of people, it is below 6%. Like that's, I think, when you start to see a lot of the metabolic and hormonal and endocrine issues that happen from basically getting below essential. So, you know, and you really, you know, the difference between, you know, this as a competitive bodybuilder, Vince, and how you look on stage, the difference if you're just like at the beach between 3 and 6% is not significant. It's only really when you're underneath the lights on stage that you start worrying about kind of pushing the envelope when it comes to essential body fat stores.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are like temporary looks for literally not even 24 hours. You know, I've competed with so many guys who are like shredded on stage, you know, at 2 p.m. on Saturday, and then on Monday at, 9 a.m., they've gained 20 pounds. And and it's not just water weight. Yeah, you know, that's a whole other conversation. I think a big thing, too, is the rate somebody drops their body fat. You know, the more extreme you go, you know, more metabolic compensation that's going to occur in that and some other ugly things. So coming down slowly in body fat is one of the most effective strategies. Again, nothing sexy, but I always teach guys that if you want to get lean, you want to do it as slow as possible. And aim for like literally 0.5% of body fat per week. And as long as it's moving down gradually, that's great. You know, I always tell guys, if you try and, force the fat off, your body's going to react. But when you try and coax the body, it's going to respond. So we're always trying to get the body to respond, and we're never trying to force anything. So that's the big thing. And then I think another thing too is, you know, the whole idea of insulin sensitivity. So the ability for somebody to utilize carbohydrates, and the leaner you get, the more you're going to be able to partition carbohydrates to muscle growth as opposed to fat stores. So one of the big things that fuels muscle growth is simply good old fashioned hard training sessions. And, you know, weight training is an anaerobic activity. So you're going to perform best with glucose. And if you can come into the gym in a state where you can train your butt off, that's what's going to be required to make gains. So if your body's utilizing those carbs better, we're going to be able to stimulate muscle growth better. And we're also going to be able to protect our muscle mass, because carbs are protein sparing, which is a huge thing. And we can lower our overall protein intake and increase our fat intake, which is also going to help with testosterone production. So I'm really big on getting guys lean, because then we can get your carbs and fats up and we can drop your protein. And I found it to be a very effective formula once somebody's in that 10 to 12% body fat range.
So a couple of things that arise here that come to mind as you're saying this. The first is, isn't this kind of an opposite approach of a lot of mass gain programs or bodybuilding programs, where you start off with a whole bunch of bulking, a whole bunch of eating, putting on copious amounts of size, and then kind of like getting shredded or getting cut after that?
Yeah, it's kind of old school now. I mean, we've really come a long ways, and what we've learned is that you can't force muscle growth in terms of like, if your body, you know, what we definitely know, the research is very clear that being in a hypercaloric state is an optimal environment for muscle growth. So essentially giving your body the materials it needs to build muscle is the state you want to be in. But at what rate it's going to occur is going to be very dependent on genetics. And, I know we'll talk a bit about some of the research in terms of, you know, what kind of gains people can make, but it's kind of like building a house. Like, you just have to provide, you know, the workers with the materials, right? I mean, that's the first thing, you know, like
everybody's into these like weird concepts these days. I don't know if they come from the marketing world or whatever, but like, you know, lean, you know, progressive bulk, like there's no such thing. There's just one type of bulking. There's bulking. You know, you're either giving your body the materials or not. Your body's going to decide what ratio of fat to muscle you're going to gain, and that's highly, highly genetic.
Now, when it comes to the actual concept from a physiological standpoint of getting lean to be able to put on muscle or getting rid of some fat to be able to put on muscle, I'm curious if you saw this study. It was really recent. It was in October in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, where they looked at anabolic sensitivity of people who were exercising. So their ability to put on size. In this case, they were looking at muscle protein synthesis. And this was in response to like eating a protein rich meal, you know, how equipped your body is to be able to build muscle after eating a protein rich meal. And what they found, and specifically like from the conclusion in the study, they found what's called diminished myofibrillar protein synthetic response to the ingestion of protein dense food if you were overweight or obese. So somehow, what they're hypothesizing is that when you have a certain amount of fat mass, you actually aren't able to take protein and convert that into muscle compared to if you were lean. And I know this study came out after you'd written the book, but I'm curious if you happen to see that at all.
I haven't seen that study, and I actually emailed Brad Schoenfeld, who's probably one of the go-to researchers.
Yeah.
In the virtual world, and I asked him if he'd seen it. And I do know that there's another study from a guy named Dr. Gilbert Forbes, and he's a pioneer in the study of body composition. And he showed that fat and lean tissue increase or decrease in relationship to each other. So, you know, when a lean person overeats, 60 to 70% of the additional weight will be lean tissue, but it'll be the opposite for someone with high body fat who will gain 60 to 70% fat and just 30 to 40% lean mass. So you're definitely, this is really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. And then the other thing, and by the way, I'll link to that study in the show notes for those of you who kind of want to see the physiological reason that you might want to consider lowering body fat before you start to try to put on size. But the other thing, I'm assuming when you say that when you get lean, you're better able to partition your glucose intake into muscle tissue, are you simply referring to the idea that like with you, when you have increased fat mass, you're not as insulin sensitive, or do you have like an increased upregulation of glucose transporters when you get lean? Like what's the mechanism whereby you become more efficient at utilizing carbohydrate if you're lean?
I believe those are both of them. There may be more, but those are definitely two of the reasons.
Okay. Gotcha. Interesting. So
it's worth mentioning the psychological aspects as well, because a lot of people who want to sculpt their physique, you know, to sculpt the physique, there is certainly a management of certain variables such as calories and macros, and beginning off in a direction where you're required to incorporate some form of restraint, whether it's portion sizes or a certain number of meals or whatever technique you employ, the entire exercise and discipline and habits that come with incorporating some form of restraint are going to help you move in a better opposite direction. So when you start reintroducing calories, you're going to have way more knowledge, data, if you will, on how your body responds and, you know, how much you should be eating and how frequently you should be eating and what kind of macro combinations are more ideal for your body. So, and what I've also find just as one more thing is when you get lean, most people are shocked by how amazing they look because they're like, holy crap. For the first time in their life, they see definition. They see rounder shoulders, a fuller chest, more vascular arms. You know, some of people might start even noticing some veins in around their stomach area, and it becomes, you start gaining more satisfaction from the discipline it takes to, you know, stick to a dietary strategy than it is to give into, you know, certain, you know, maybe food temptations that you would have given into earlier on. So mentally, you just like, you start loving the results you're getting So that's a huge thing. So you really increase compliance when you get leaner. And a lot of people that I've even found is that they get lean. And the new thing now, you know, even within my friends, we joke around like, you know, 'tis the season to be lean. Like lean is in. It's like the big, big muscular, you know, physique. It's kind of out. Like kind of like 10 years ago. Be right. A certain percentage of the population that just, you know what I'm saying? It's like lean is in. So a lot of people just get 10-12% body fat and they're like, crap, I love the way I look right now. I don't need to add any more mass. Maybe I'll focus on improving my shoulders and I'll stay at maintenance calories or just, you know, increase calories a bit on those, you know, shoulder and arm days. But that whole idea of like overfeeding constantly where, you know, you got to take your Tupperware container everywhere. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, a lot. I mean, I'm not appealing to those kind of guys. And a lot of people have evolved beyond that. And like, we just want to look good, you know, for the opposite sex. And we want to look good amongst our peers and we want to feel good. And the whole bulking up and cutting down, it's just those extreme lifestyles are just of like no interest to, you know, the kind of people that I want to help and the kind of lifestyle that I live now.
Yeah. I think a lot of people too, don't realize, how big you can actually look when you're somewhat lean, if it's size that you're going for. You know, a lot of times the decrease in body fat is just as important as the increase in muscle mass. And you're right. I think people in this day and age can look a little bit better looking like, say, Brad Pitt from Fight Club versus Arnold Schwarzenegger from the Terminator. I think the former is a better look.
There's this cool thing called the lean threshold, and it basically states that guys between the percentage body fat of 13 and 18% don't really look any different. So if you had a guy, it would be very hard to tell, like, is he 13% or 18%? It kind of looks the same almost. But once you get down to 10, 12% body fat, you immediately look, you know, you look dramatically different and you do look bigger. It's funny because I'm 203 right now, and if you read comments on my Instagram and Facebook, people ask me, "Holy cow, you've packed on a lot of size." I've actually lost 10 pounds. Well, this past year, I've just been refocusing on rebuilding my metabolism from some bad habits in the past, and my goal has just been to lower my set point on the scale, and it's required a very slow and tedious process. But it's, you know, it's taken a year to drop 10 pounds. But now that I'm 10 pounds leaner, everyone says, wow, you look a lot better. You look bigger. And I'm like, I've lost weight. I'm lighter on the scale. So that's one of the big benefits of getting leaner. You do, in fact, look better when you have some muscle in the right spots.
Yeah. And the thing that you go into in the book specifically for putting on the muscle side of things is something called DTS training, DTS training. And that's kind of like what I was messing around with in the gym yesterday and why my chest is so sore. But can you go into what you mean when you say DTS?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of the marketer in me, just to be honest. But Brad Schoenfeld came out with some research in 2010 and he discovered there's three mechanisms of muscle growth: muscle damage, metabolic stress, and mechanical tension. And there's different training techniques to stimulate those different mechanisms. So my training program essentially takes principles from science and then incorporates my own techniques to get that stimulus achieved. And, you know, one, it's effective because that's what the science has shown. And two, it's because we're now incorporating variety into our training program. So when we come to the gym, we're not just doing four sets of, you know, 10 to 12, you know, we might be doing a certain amount of sets and reps, but with a very specific tempo. Maybe you noticed on one of the days we're doing, you know, really slow eccentrics, and that's designed to stimulate muscle damage. So, you know, one of the workouts in your week, you get to come to the gym with a specific goal. Okay, today's my really slow eccentric day. And you have a very specific goal with each workout. You know, another one of the workouts is where we're focusing on mechanical tension, which is just heavy lifting. And that's the day where we just focus on adding more weight to the bar. The rep ranges come down, the rest periods lengthen, the tempo speed up a bit. And the whole purpose of that day, that's your heavy day. That's the day you get to come to the gym. That's the day that you get to focus on adding more weight to the bar. And then another workout, we have our metabolic stress day. And that's just a fancy way of saying high volume training. And that's the day where we get to go for the pump. We get to crank out a lot of reps with very short rest periods. And the entire focus of that workout is to make the muscle burn. And that's how I design my programs. There's goals with each program utilizing the mechanisms of muscle growth. And there's a lot of way to skillfully organize and periodize those. And then, you know, people buy my stuff because I've got really creative and fun ways of, you know, using certain techniques that stimulate those mechanisms. And, you know, I just use DTS as a simple way for people, you know, a fun way for people to remind, you know, keep, you know, to remember right. What we're doing here.
Now, in terms of mechanical tension, one of the things you mentioned that I want to make sure I highlight to folks is that a lot of times you only get the activation of type 2 muscle fibers when the type 1 muscle fibers are fatigued, which I know is one reason why you recommend to lift heavy. But do you actually go out of your way in the program or in your own training to pre-fatigue type 1 muscle fibers, like to do something, for example? I remember I would do some of this back when I was a bodybuilder, right? You'd do a set of push-ups or a set of chest flies or something that is relatively light, high rep to pre-fatigue type 1 muscle fibers before you go in and hit the type 2 muscle fibers with, say, like a bench press or some other kind of loaded press.
Yeah, no, that's certainly an effective technique, and that's definitely going to shock your body. It is something that you could incorporate. It definitely is something. So now we're kind of mixing multiple mechanisms into one workout. And that's actually what we do in phase 3 of the program. I have you doing all 3 mechanisms in one workout. So we're building up to that. So there are certainly different ways and techniques to go about doing that. So, you know, for me, it's like every technique has an expiration date though. So we set, you know, a date to the technique. So maybe 8 weeks or 10 weeks, and then we move on to a different technique, because that's what the research has really pointed to, that, you know, muscle growth doesn't occur in a linear fashion. It really occurs in spurts, which is what a lot of people don't understand. So, you know, rotating your techniques is essential.
The other thing that's kind of interesting that you have in the book is you don't like this concept of pausing at the top or the bottom, right? Like a lot of people will do a squat or a dead or a curl or any other movement, and you kind of pause at the top and you pause at the bottom, you know, like basically, I guess what would be referred to as inter-rep rest. Why aren't you a fan of that?
Yeah, well, so when it comes to applying the mechanism of metabolic stress, what we're striving for is called constant tension. So we want to get as much lactic acid into the muscle. And what that requires is constant tension. So, you know, muscles, you know, numbers when it comes to constant tension are arbitrary. So when we're talking about increasing stress, fatigue, cell swelling, lactic acid, different byproducts within the muscle that make the muscle burn, what we want to do is make it as hard as humanly possible on your muscles. And what that basically requires is constant tension. So we don't want to give the muscle a rest at the top or the bottom. We want constant tension, understanding that I teach this concept called the principle of disadvantages. And essentially what we're trying to present to our body is a disadvantage. You know, when it comes to building muscle, this is the big thing. You want to make it as hard as possible. This isn't CrossFit. This isn't endurance sport. This is not any type of performance sport where you're trying to become more efficient. You want to stay inefficient. You want to make it as hard as possible on your muscles. And that's why, you know, we use, you know, things like lock it down, don't pause, squeeze it like it owes you money, contract against the resistance, you know, own each inch of the weight, don't let the tension off, keep it on. You know, if you came to one of my muscle camps, you'd hear me saying all those things to you while you're in the midst of a set, because we want to keep the tension directed to the tissue, the muscle tissue that you're trying to stimulate. And what happens is a lot of guys go to the gym and they just move weight.
Yeah.
Its body is designed to always chase the path of least resistance. So let's say you're doing a bench press with 200 pounds. Well, your body will figure out how to disperse that 200 pounds to as many body parts as possible, because it has zero interest in building muscle. But if you want to build your chest, apply concepts like inward intent so that you direct the torque to the muscle tissue that you're specifically trying to sculpt. So it really does come require that kind of like, hey, coming to the gym and saying, what's my goal? What am I trying to do? Am I trying to just lift more weight, or am I actually trying to sculpt a muscle? And those require different mindsets, techniques, and ways of performing the exercise.
Now, in your section of the book on recovery, you talk about massage, and a lot of people think of massage as a way to recover. You talk about massage as a way to build muscle. How is it that that massage therapy or deep tissue therapy or foam rolling or something like that would actually cause a muscle building response?
Yeah. So with regards to massage, I think the big idea with, you know, any kind of therapy that increases mobility is that, yeah, you're going to get better blood flow and you're going to help promote recovery. But, you know, one of the things that I will caution people with in, you know, in terms of different modalities such as, you know, foam rolling, stretching, massage, and even stuff like ART is that while it can increase the neurological function of a muscle by improving the communication between it and the nervous system, you also have to ensure that you have other tools. One in particular that I'm a huge fan of called MAT, which stands for muscle activation techniques.
Yeah, you talk about this a lot in the book. You seem pretty obsessed with this MAT thing.
Yeah, because here's the deal, man. I mean, a lot of people don't understand how the body actually works, because I was trained to believe early on that if a muscle's tight, that's a bad thing. You know, if a muscle's tight, you should stretch it. And one day I had somebody just ask me, you know, why are you stretching? That, like, why are you really trying to push your range of motion? And I said, well, because the muscle's tight. And he simply asked, well, why is that a bad thing? And no one's ever asked me that. Like, why? What do you mean? Why is that a bad thing? The muscle's tight. You don't want tight muscles. And he presented this entire new way of kind of looking at the body. And he was an MAT therapist, muscle activation techniques therapist. And, you know, their whole thing is that flexibility is a derivative of strength, and muscle tightness is secondary to muscle weakness. So whenever you see a limitation in motion, this is an indication that one or more of the muscles that cross that axis cannot contract efficiently. And when a muscle or a group of muscles cannot contract efficiently, it means that they cannot effectively shorten. This in turn means the muscles of the opposite axis cannot fully lengthen. And this inefficiency in muscle contraction is expressed as muscle tightness. So this was like, this kind of like blew my world wide open, because, you know, I never understood, you know, I thought, okay, something's tight, but, you know, if you go on an ice rink, do you want your muscles to tighten up? Yes, because if your muscles tighten up, it's going to prevent you from doing a face plant and cracking your head open. So muscle tightness is actually a good thing. So what I always tell people, whenever you add mobility to a joint axis, you better have a tool that adds stability. And MAT gives stability by turning muscle tissue back on so muscle tissue can actually contract. And that's why I'm a huge fan of MAT, because muscle MAT is going to really, what it does is it focuses on the cause of pain by, you know, testing, correcting, and then maintaining muscle contractile efficiency. But from, you know, a physique standpoint, it's pretty fascinating, because, you know, if you look at certain body parts, you know, if you look at pro bodybuilders, you got a guy, you know, maybe on Instagram with a massive set of shoulders and a massive set of arms, but he's got no chest. Like, what is that all about? Like, is that because he doesn't know how to train his chest, or he wimps out on chest day? Why is his shoulders and arms so developed and his chest is underdeveloped, or his back is underdeveloped? Well, it's because of movement patterns and ability to contract muscle tissue in certain areas. He may have the inability to contract his pecs and his back properly. So whenever he goes to the gym and lifts, his shoulders and arms are forced to take more of the load and are simply more developed because they've experienced more tension over the years.
Interesting. Yeah, I have a podcast. I think I recorded about 3 years ago. It's called Dr. Two Fingers Reveals His Teeth Gritting Body Healing Secrets. And he goes into this concept called Advanced Muscle Integrative Technique, or AMIT, which is based around the fact that every single section of tissue in your body is saturated with these proprioceptors, and they monitor like tension and pressure and movement and temperature and compression and all these different things. And basically, if you get injured or you have a lot of inflammation from a workout, the receptors become kind of protective, and then they shut off function, or they shut off mobility in an area. And what he does is he actually applies really deep pressure, right? Like with two fingers or one finger or with some kind of instrument in specific proprioceptive areas of the body. And from what I understand, like MAT that you talk about a lot in the book, this muscle activation technique, I think it's based on the same concepts as this advanced muscle integrative technique, or AMIT, except I think there's a little bit more, if I understand correctly, like focus on range of motion and different exercises with a practitioner with MAT. So it's like a combination of functional movement along with actually like putting pressure on a specific area and just reaming the hell out of it with fingers or some kind of a device.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know too much about that. It'd be interesting to have the two creators talk to each other about how they go about. I mean, I know there's a lot of different body healers out there, and you know, my thing, you know, whenever I talk about MAT, you know, never try and put down any other body healer out there, because I know they all contribute to their methodology and achieve results. So what I do know about the MAT is that it really just looks at the body in terms of what's not contracting. And when we can turn that back on, then other muscles essentially don't have to keep picking up the slack, if you will. And that's the big thing with injuries, right? People don't understand, you know, how injuries work. They go to their guy and they say, oh, I pulled my hamstring, when, you know, it might not, you know, oftentimes there's nothing wrong with the hamstring. The hamstring was like completely fine. Maybe it was something wrong with the left glute that wasn't contracting, so the right hamstring had to work harder and just eventually got so pissed off at the left glute that he's not doing his job. He had to overwork, and that's when he got hurt. So
yeah.
That's kind of been my experience with the MAT. Whenever I go see my guy, I say, hey, this, you know, my shoulder's bothering me. He treats something in my foot. He doesn't even touch my shoulder, and I leave and the pain in my shoulder is gone. I'm like, what did you do? And he goes, well, you know, there was instability in your, you know, base of support in your feet. I turned some feet stuff back on, and now, you know, the tension is like literally it's not getting dumped into your shoulder. And that's essentially what you're doing with MAT. You're turning musculature back on so that everything can do its job and other muscles don't have to pick up the slack and get pissed off that the guy's not doing their job, which end up, you know, eventually either getting hurt or in some cases overdevelop. And that's how you get these different physiques out there with, like, you know, why is his, you know, that, but why is that body part so well developed?
Right.
Body part so underdeveloped. And almost 100% of the time, it doesn't have to do with like, it's obviously like a neurological deficiency that, you know, typically needs to get, it can be improved with exercise technique. Actually, I shouldn't say 100%, but
yeah. Cool. So with the use of, or I should say without the use of what we would call gear in the muscle building world, right? Like steroids or andro or testosterone derivatives, et cetera. What is actually, based on research, a realistic rate of muscle gain? I know it's going to change a little bit based on whether you're, say, mesomorphic or ectomorphic in terms of body type, but what kind of information can you give folks listening in as far as what to expect when it comes to the ability to put on muscle and how quickly one can do so?
Yeah, it'd be fun to sit on this question for a bit, because I actually have a lot to share here. I think the first thing I want to do is just to kind of dispel the whole myth in terms of how muscle is built. And I think a lot of people think that, you know, people with a big muscular physique gained it over like a long gradual period of time. They just gained a little bit of muscle, you know, bit by bit, and eventually they had that big awesome physique. And it doesn't work like that. The way it works is that people gain muscle in spurts, and they gain large amounts of muscle in a very short period of time, but then they hit a plateau. And they won't gain anything for, you know, a certain period of time, if not a long period of time, before they introduce a different training stimulus that shocks their body. And then they might make another big surge in muscle growth. And that okay. was my experience. You know, I went from 149 to 190 in 6 months.
I'm going to interrupt you just real quick. Are you getting a beep on your end? Did you just get a beep?
Yeah, I turned it. I just quit, hit a quit. Yeah, I was trying to shut it down while we were talking.
Oh, I got you. I thought it was on my end. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Okay, sorry to like totally derail you there. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there's a researcher named Haken, and he's from Finland. I don't know if I pronounce it right, but he's done more studies on strength training than anyone, and he's shown that, you know, we don't gain in that linear fashion. You know, you shock your body and make huge gains, and then you plateau. And then you make huge gains again, and then you plateau. And this is very similar with a lot of newbies, including myself. You know, I gained 40 pounds in 6 months, but then, you know, I spent, I think, 2-3 years hovering around 190, 195. You know, it was hard to make that leap again. So when we look at the research, there was a study done by Dr. Jose Antonio, and he had several people in this study. It was an 8-week study, and a number of people in the study gained 13 pounds of lean mass over a course of 8 weeks, which is 6 kilograms of muscle. Now, in the same study, what they found were some guys made literally zero gains, and there were some guys in the study that literally lost muscle mass. So, you know, I have my theory on why that happened, but pretty much the majority of research has shown, all the research I've found, including a guy that's done a ton of studies on this from the University of McMaster in Ontario. His name's Dr. Stu Phillips, and he's done a lot of research tackling short-term training programs. And what he has consistently notices that guys gain on average between 4 and 7 pounds of lean mass in a course of 3 months.
And okay.
That's kind of like what is the average. But like I was just sharing with Dr. Jose's study, there was a couple guys that gained almost twice that amount. So it's really, you know, what's going on here? Well, in my opinion, 90% of this is driven by genetics. You know, genetics is kind of like, you know, it's kind of the driving thing with all of this. So now
what about Alan Argon? Have you seen any of his research in terms of like his natural, what he calls his lean muscle mass gain model?
Yeah.
And what he says? Because his is based off whether you're beginner, intermediate, or advanced. And he says if you're beginner, right? Like if you've been training 1 year or less, he says basically you take 1 to 1.5% of your total body weight, and that's how much you could put on per month. So if you weigh like I suppose, you know, 180 pounds, you would be able to put on 1.8 to, I suppose it would be about 2.4-ish pounds of muscle per month. Or if you're intermediate, you know, the more advanced you get, the more it slows down. So he says if you're an intermediate trainer, it's 0.5 to 1% total body weight per month. And then if you're advanced, so you've been training for like 5 years or more, it's about 0.25 to 0.5% of your total body weight per month you could put on. So again, if you're like 180, it would be like almost less than a pound of muscle per month that you could put on based off of what science says about hypertrophy or muscle building potential. Do you think that that's too conservative? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
No, that's great. I know Alan's work very well. I know, you know, Lyle McDonald, he has another similar thing too. And, you know, I also follow a guy named I don't know if he's a doctor, David Epstein. And in the Sports Gene, he has a definitive answer to how much muscle an individual can pack on. And it's 5 pounds for every pound of bone. Unfortunately, you need a DEXA scan to figure out how much muscle and bone you have. And
So that would be like the biggest that you could get would be 5 pounds per 1 pound of bone, like your maximum size you could ever put on.
According to David Epstein, yeah.
That's really interesting. I've had DEXA scans done before. I should go back and see how much bone I have, because I've always wondered, right? Like, what would I top out at if I really just like ate everything in sight and lifted heavy weights for 3 or 4 years? Like, what would be my actual genetic potential? I wasn't familiar with that, though. I've read his Sports Gene book. So I'm going to have to go look at my DEXA scan results now and see just how swole I could theoretically get.
Yeah, and this is interesting because we actually just had my brother, he was the guy who went to the Olympic trials for the 800 meters. So he's, you know, comes from a very, very competitive background of middle distance running, and he got the genes in the family, you know, good looks as well. He's way better looking than me and way more articulate and everything else. But, you know, he wanted to do a 12-week transformation. So he went on a program that my coach put him on, and I helped him with all the technique because we work out together. And we told him, do your DEXA, man. Like, we wanted to see what he was actually going to gain. And I sent you the pictures, and he gained 20 pounds in 12 weeks. And if you look at his pictures, I guarantee most people will say, holy cow, he gained 20 pounds of muscle, because it doesn't look like he's gained any body fat. Like, look at the pictures. I told him, take the pictures in the same position with the same posing. Don't screw around with the light. Don't screw around with any apps or anything. Like, I want it. Let's see what you can actually do in 12 weeks. And I sent you the pictures, and he got his DEXA scan results, and he was like, he was so disappointed because he only gained 4 pounds of lean mass according to the DEXA. And even to myself, I'm kind of boggled because I don't see 16 pounds of body fat on his frame, but it did say that of the 20 pounds he gained, 16 was fat. But, you know, it's pretty amazing how the body can still look amazing 20 pounds heavier. And I mean, you got to put the pictures up on your show notes, because I thought it was just absolutely fascinating. So,
yeah, you sent me the photos, and they're pretty impressive. So I'll link to it. Again, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/livinglarge, I'll link to these photos of Vince's, brother that they're actually pretty impressive. They're from your Instagram page, right?
Yeah. I think what I just want to say with, in terms of my thoughts on these different, you know, models for what's realistic, again, it's just the model. I mean, my story, I mean, I'll be honest, it's the way I built my name and my brand and my business. It was my, you know, very incredible before and after pictures. I mean, I gained 40 pounds. I mean, to this day, people still accuse me of steroids. Sorry about that. I'll turn that off. I don't know why that's doing that. Still says, you know, people still think, oh, he must have used steroids. But again, you know, they're newbie gains. I mean, so there are going to be guys that blow away these models, and there will be guys that don't even come close to getting into the average. So, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, while it is a model, some guys are going to blow it away, and some guys won't even come close to hitting it. Just like that study showed, where some guys gained 6 kilos of muscle and some guys lost muscle in the same 8-week study. So there's a lot of variables for that, but we kind of have to look at the average. And I think the average, a lot of scientists are agreed that 4 to 7 pounds over a 12-week period is considered. If you hit that, good for you. You pat yourself on the back. You did a lot of things right.
Got it. Okay, cool. And we'll put some of the links to these resources and calculators in the show notes for those of you listening in. A few other quick questions that I have for you in the time that we have left, Vince, and that would be kind of like the food related side of things. You have some interesting thoughts on food in general, and I'm glad to see that you've progressed from the days of, as you write about in the intro of your book, basically dipping things in peanut butter and drinking copious amounts of Gatorade and eating lots and lots of macaroni and cheese and power bars. But you talk about your 7 key oils. You recommend rotating 7 key oils through the diet. Why do you recommend rotating those through the diet? And what are your 7 go-to oils that you have on hand?
Yeah, for sure. I'll be honest, I don't have a scientific answer for this. It's more from just something I learned from one of my nutrition coaches a long time ago. And he said, you know, if you want to look solid, eat solid food. And he was a huge proponent of just, you know, really focus on variety and rotating food sources. And for me, I just wanted to expand my repertoire. So, you know, I regularly try and rotate around olive oil, coconut oil, avocado oil, grape seed oil, flaxseed, walnut oil. And they all just kind of have different flavors, tastes. You know, my wife, as you know, is has taken a lot of professional cooking lessons, and we just try and, you know, explore and learn different things and make things taste differently. And certain things have different, you know, heat points are
different smoke points. It's funny, your tactic is similar to mine, right? So I have what I have on hand all the time is I've got ghee, butter, coconut oil, avocado oil and two others, olive oil and then MCT oil. Like, so I always have some different fats and oils that I can play around with, not super scientifically, you know, sometimes it's just for flavor more than anything else, but sometimes there is some science behind it, right? Like if I've cooked my eggs in coconut oil in the morning, for example, then I might in the evening, if I'm doing a saute or cooking up a steak or something like that, I might use an extra virgin olive oil or an avocado oil. So I'm getting different blends of my monounsaturated MUFAs and my polyunsaturated PUFAs throughout the day with some MCT thrown in. And yeah, I think it is important not to just like have your, which I know a lot of people have, just like your go-to bottle of extra virgin olive oil and maybe, you know, your stick of butter in the refrigerator. I kind of like the idea of having a variety of different oils in the diet.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I do the same thing with my proteins. I try to never have the same protein source twice in the same day.
Really?
And that was a challenge from somebody who said you should try and eat different protein sources. And that was just that one question just forced me to ask, well, how many protein sources are there out there? So yeah, no, I like to rotate my protein sources, you know, fish, turkey, chicken, egg whites, different kinds of meats, different kinds of, you know, cuts. Eggs.
Really? Do you do egg whites?
I do egg whites. I feel
I'm not into egg whites.
You know, I don't do them all the time. It's a bit of, you know, it's one of those things when I'm more trying to control, manage, you know, exactly what I want. But, you know, I definitely like the enzymes that come from obviously an egg. I have whole eggs way more often than just egg whites. But again, it's just one option if I need like pure 50 grams of protein and I'm getting my fats from some other sources that day. Again, it's not like something I'm set on, but you know, sometimes I like to start the day with I call it the bro breakfast, you know, cause it's pretty old school, but, you know, oatmeal and egg whites. And you know, you put some cinnamon on it or, you know, sometimes I add some oatmeal to the egg whites and you make an oatmeal egg white pancake and you can add some jam. So it's like, again, this isn't gourmet cooking by any means, you know, a professional chef would be rolling their eyes if they heard me saying all this, but it kind of gets the job done every once in a while.
Yeah, I guess I'm too big of a fan of all the, you know, the A, the D, the E and the K and the fat soluble vitamins and everything in the yolk that I stray away from egg whites. Plus, I guess I get disillusioned with them too, because I used to do more of them and had really, really high levels of albumin. You can get like a blood test for albumin. And I find this is the case with people who eat a lot of eggs in general, people who eat a lot of egg whites, especially like really, really high levels of this albumin based protein. And I suspect part of that might be from getting a whole bunch of the egg white protein without the egg yolks and some of the fats that accompany the egg with the egg yolk. So I'm personally careful with egg whites. But you also talk about protein powders in the book and how you're actually not really stuck on whey, which a lot of bodybuilders are. So you say whey is not the only way. I see what you did there. But what are the other protein powders that you use?
Yeah, so I like to rotate proteins around for the same reason. Sorry, protein powders for the same reason I like to rotate proteins. So whey, for one, it's highly insulinogenic, so meaning it may not be the best choice for someone over 15% body fat who needs to lose fat. And for many people who are over, you know, 12, 15% body fat who need to drop body fat first, they'd be just better off with a whole food meal. Even though insulin sensitivity is heightened after training, you know, I would advise to eating as much whole food as possible and rotating different protein powders, because again, you're just getting different amino acid profiles. And, you know, some of them, even like one of my favorites, hemp protein, you know, you're going to get a good omega profile and you're going to get different nutrients. And, you know, whey by itself doesn't have the greatest nutrient profile compared to say eating steak or whole eggs or fish. So when you're looking for nutrient density with your meal, you know, maximizing quality, before quantity, you really want to just consider your sources. So for guys who are trying to gain weight, though, you know, I tell guys you can definitely incorporate a shake, maybe one, no more than two per day, you know, two maximum per day, but, you know, ideally one. That way the majority of your food is coming from sustaining food that's nutrient rich. It's got a lot of micronutrients, fiber, omega profile, you know, healthy fats. And that's the biggest thing, you know, from the research when it comes to muscle growth, it really comes down to just hitting your total protein goal per day. So like, let's say you need to hit, you know, 200 grams of protein per day, you know, whether, you know, having a whey shake, you know, people say, well, it's more quickly absorbed. Well, after a workout, that is true because insulin sensitivity is higher, but we're not talking like, you know, the difference between like big gains and average gains. Like, I'll be honest, this is what I call majoring in the minors. And it's not going to move the needle a whole lot. You know, if it's a more convenient way to hit your daily protein intake, limit it to one, maybe two on really busy days, but that's it. The more whole food you can eat, the better. And that's why I always tell guys, you know, if you want to look solid, you got to eat solid food. And then there's just a couple other reasons. There's been some research to show that it might destabilize gut bacteria. And for people who are obviously allergic to dairy or aren't aware that they're allergic to dairy, they might want to cut it out. And, you know, a lot of people that have whey, they experience digestive issues like bloating, gas, loose stools. And that obviously means there's something going on in their machinery that, you know, isn't making whey a great choice. And I find guys that only have whey experience this more often as opposed to people that rotate in, say, rice protein, pea protein, hemp protein. So I'm a huge believer. Like, if you look in my cupboards, I've got a lot of different protein powders and I rotate them around. So I'm not fixed on whey. The old Vince was just whey. But now I like to rotate my protein powders and I haven't noticed any negative difference. And I get just one last point. It's like really just focusing on being a healthy individual, right? Because if your body's functioning, you know, all your, you know, hormones, your immune system, you know, all your different systems in your body are functioning properly, you're going to build muscle better. So it all comes back to focusing on being healthy first and then aesthetic second.
Yeah. With proteins, I too used to be just stuck on whey protein. You know, I was sponsored by, I don't know if you remember ABB, they used to do the bodybuilding shakes in the cans. And I would suck down like five or six of those a day and was always under the impression that either whey protein isolate or prior to bed, whey and casein were kind of the most superior protein powders for muscle building. And not only have I come to the conclusion, similar to you, that whole food is far better, far more absorptible, if that's a word, and produces far fewer of the infamous protein farts. You know, when you're consuming like egg and chicken and beef versus protein powders, and protein farts are just nasty, acrid things. They're horrible. But the other thing that I found is that, that vegan based proteins like hemp and pea and rice, they've got some really interesting studies on those that show that when you consume a bunch of digestive enzymes, prior to consuming those, that you actually increase the bioavailability just as high as like a whey protein or an animal based protein. So that's another hack you can use if whey protein doesn't agree with you, is you just swallow a bunch of digestive enzymes before you have your vegan based protein powder.
I'm a huge fan of proteolytic enzymes, and I have a specific product jacked up with that. And I take a proteolytic probiotic as well that just specializes on protein. So I'm always about trying to get more from less. So, you know, if I can consume, and there's some really interesting research too on enzymes in terms of like, you know, when your body has more proteolytic enzymes, you're going to absorb more of the protein, right? Or if you don't have the proteolytic enzymes in your body will have to rob them from other tissues. And it becomes like a vicious cycle where you have to consume more protein, but you're getting less from it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing. Bodybuilders, no one's really talking about this. I think enzymes are going to blow up over the next few years in the bodybuilding industry, especially once guys start like, you know, just get sick and tired of doing 300 plus grams of protein a day and realize that they can get just as good results on half of it if they're giving their body the enzymes to break those proteins down to amino acids so that their body can actually utilize them.
That's a really good point. If you're shoving your face full of protein and not putting on size, part of it might be enzymatic deficiencies or hydrochloric acid deficiencies, not a protein deficiency. You might just not have what you need on board to break down the protein. That's a really good point. And we've been going for a while, Vince, so I want to respect your time. And what I'll do for any of you listening in, just go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/livinglarge. And I'll link not only to the previous podcast I did with Vinny's wife, which is actually really fascinating when it comes to like kitchen tools and stuff like that, but also photos of Vince's brother, Michael, and his impressive muscle gain using this program. I'll link to the book if you want to pick it up and go through it as a guide to no-nonsense muscle building. Some of the studies that we talked about and my podcast on the advanced muscle integrated regenerative technique or the muscle activation technique and plenty more. So if you have any questions when you go over there for Vince or for me, leave them in the comments right under there underneath the show in the show notes. And then also leave a review in iTunes. If you dug this show, if you got something out of it, be sure to give us a little love on iTunes. Leave a review. So Vince, thanks for coming on the show and sharing all this with us, man.
And it was an honor, man.
Cool. Well, folks, until next time, I'm Ben Greenfield, along with Vince Del Monte, the skinny guy's savior, signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have a healthy week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.